Welcome to We The Podcast, the show about how the people outside of the billionaire and millionaire class, you know, most of us, engage the economy. This week on We The Podcast, we take it back to the classroom. George Lakoff, who wrote Don't Think of an Elephant, is a professor of cognitive linguistics and philosophy at the University of California at Berkeley. He's not an ivory tower guy. He writes and talks about practical things that we can use. Now, you might be asking yourself, what do cognitive science, linguistic science, and phenomenology have to do with working families and the economy? Well, it turns out quite a bit. George Lakoff studies the brain, how people actually think, how they process ideas, including politics. You know, how do the words that we use and the things that we say shape what we believe? You know, the question is, why do some folks, working people included, vote for politicians who vote against them? How are politicians like Donald Trump and others able to tell ridiculous lies, vote against working people, refuse to increase the minimum wage, try to take health care away from working people, and still gain the support of working people? You know, what can progressives do to help convince folks that things like universal health care, free college, and stopping climate change are right for them and their families? A lot of it has to do with how we talk, the frames that we use. A lot of it has to do with what George Lakoff studies every single day.
Well, you know, you've been a researcher for decades, and you have really taught so many people about the importance of words and the impact of framing and how to really talk about critical subjects. You've written a lot of books, but the one a lot of folks know about is your 2004 book, which is entitled Don't Think of an Elephant. I want to recommend it to everybody. I reread it after you gave me an updated copy, George. Thank you for that. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about what got you involved in thinking about the power of words and framing, and more importantly, how that helped you understand why liberals, progressives, need to really learn a little bit more about cognitive linguistics.
Okay, well, it's an interesting story. I had gone to MIT, and when I was there, I was taught that thought was like logic. It's like doing proofs in logic. And I believed that for a while. I was an early linguist in the Chomskyan tradition. I was one of his earlier students. And he had a theory that language was independent of thought. That turned out not to be true. Obviously, it's not independent of thought and meaning. And if meaning was logic, I constructed a theory in which meaning could be logic. And then I worked with the major logicians of the day for about 12 years trying to make this work, and it didn't. By about 1974-75, three of my Berkeley colleagues in the cognitive sciences found that this was impossible, and it was impossible for a number of reasons. First, it turns out that thought has everything to do with the brain. You think with your brain, ideas don't float in the air, and neural circuitry doesn't work by logic. Secondly, it turns out that thought is embodied. That is, it's not just purely in your brain. It is the brain's connected to the body, and those connections to the body and to the world through your body matter. And we found lots and lots of examples where that really mattered a great deal. But the main thing that had to do with framing was discovered by my colleague Charles Fillmore in 1975. He discovered that every word in every language is defined by a mental structure, which he called a frame. Mm-hmm. It was quite remarkable. It's a very simple kind of structure if you think about it, and you can't think without using frames. It's absolutely normal. So, you know, if I say, You know, what is an interview? You have two people talking, an interviewer, an interviewee, questions that are asked by the interviewer, responses by the interviewee, etc. In the middle of this, there's no surgery done by the interviewer. There's no elephants coming through the room as part of the frame, and so on. The frame is very simple. And your whole life is made up with these things. Every institution you know about, every normal thing that you do is structured in terms of those frames. And those frames can be literal or metaphorical. I discovered how metaphorical thought worked back in 1978, and it became clear that many of the frames were metaphorical. So that was the, and that this had to be done with neural circuitry, and we're now finishing a book with, I'm finishing a book with Srini Narayanan, who's the world's expert on neural computation. Mm-hmm. And what we've been doing is finding out, after 25 years of research, how you actually think using neural circuitry. A lot has been learned. And what I've been doing is applying that to the study of politics. And that study came about in the following way. When Gingrich took over the Republican Party and the Congress in 1994, he sponsored a book called The Contract with America, written by Frank Luntz. And what the Republican candidate said was that if you elect us, here's what we'll do. We'll make sure that there are no abortions. And not only that, we'll make sure that there's a flat tax. But what does a flat tax have to do with abortion, I asked myself. And then they said, we'll make sure that everyone can own guns. Well, wait a minute. What does owning guns have to do with abortions and the flat tax? And they said, we'll make sure that there are no environmental regulations. Well, what does that have to do with the other things? And, you know, so it seemed mysterious. These are strange people to me. But then I said, wait a minute. I have exactly the opposite views. What is the generalization that I have? And I couldn't answer it. But I saw that this was a problem in cognitive science. It's my field. So I actually studied it. And in about 6 months, I realized, when I asked myself why conservatives worry about family values so much, that one of my students had written a paper pointing out that we all have a metaphor that the nation is a family. We have founding fathers. Nobody says, what do you mean fathers? I mean, it seems natural. We have the nation, we send our sons and daughters to war. We have homeland security, etc. The idea of the nation as a family is a normal kind of nation. It's a metaphor that we all have naturally. And so I asked myself, if there are two different views of the nation, there might be two different views of the family. So having studied the structure of conceptual metaphor, I worked backwards, and out popped two different views of the family. A nurturing parent family that went along with progressives, and a strict father family that went along with conservatives. And then it was pointed out to me by friends who were Bible translators and part of the Christian Coalition that James Dobson had been pointing this out all along, had a strict father view of the family and saw that as intimately related to politics, both international and national. So when I read through the Dobson materials, it was very clear that this how this was working. What I figured out was this. I figured out that first, in conservative views, a strict father is in charge of the family, and the father justifies this by saying that he knows what's right. Father knows best. He knows what's right and wrong. And his job is to make sure that his children do what's right, that they grow up to be moral beings. And the only way he can do this is by telling them what to do. And if they don't do what he does, if they just do what feels good to them instead of doing what he does, then his job is to punish them painfully enough so that they'll not do what feels good, but get the discipline to do what he says. And if they have that discipline, they can go out in the world and be prosperous. So what happens if they're not prosperous? That means they don't have discipline, and they can't be moral, and therefore they deserve their poverty. Now, what this says about politics is that poor people are lazy. that they should be disciplined and out there, making money in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this, but it's more than this, because it's not just a moral view of what's right in the family and in general, of right and wrong there. It is claimed to be natural, the way the world actually works normally. And from this perspective, you can then see who is more moral than who by seeing who is more disciplined than who won out. Look at history, see who won out. So religion has won out. You have God above nature in this moral hierarchy. We have conquered nature. Therefore, it's man above nature. We can do what we want with nature. Drill, baby, drill. Strong above the weak. We need to have the strongest military in the world because we're the best nation in the world in order to maintain that view. What about the wealthy people? Well, the rich above the poor. Why? They earned it. They deserve it. Employers above employees. And down the hierarchy you go. Adults above children in 21 states. It is legal for teachers and coaches to beat children with sticks and paddles if they don't just do what they're told. If they sass back and they, argue with the teacher or the coach, then they can be beaten. Then you have Western culture above non-Western culture, America above other nations, men above women, whites above non-whites, Christians above non-Christians, straights above gays. That is, this is that moral hierarchy. And you see that moral hierarchy all the time in Republican conservative legislation. Virtually every conservative piece of legislation is fitting some part of that hierarchy, and you see it in Donald Trump. You see it in all of his attitudes. So what you have is a strict father view that explains what it is that ties Trumpism and together with the conservative Republicans, but it explains something even deeper, because there are a lot of people who have mainly strict father morality. There are versions of it that are weaker than that, which we can get to. But if you have mainly strict father morality and you think, and that is what determines your moral view, then since everyone thinks that they're moral or try to be moral, that they think they're doing right all the time, then their very identity is tied up with what's right, with their moral views. So if you have that view, then strict father morality defines who you are as a person. And you're not going to vote against who you are as a person. And it,
right.
And since the Goldwater loss way back in 1964, there's been about 37% plus or minus 2 of our population has been people who have mainly strict father morality. They may have some progressive views or other, but they mainly have strict father morality. And you see that in the polls. You see that no matter what Trump does, even if he wants to take people's health care away, people are not giving up on him. He's still getting 37, 39% in those polls.
Yeah.
And, there's a reason for that. The reason is that people will support Trump because he has legitimized them as human beings, as people who have that view of morality, whereas under Obama they felt oppressed, that their government, their country, was not legitimizing them as human beings.
Hmm.
And even though Trump and the Republicans may want to take health care away from many of them, it's more important that they're legitimized as human beings.
Well, so here's a question for you. As someone who believes that you should be able to go to the doctor when you're sick, that the government has a role to make sure that that can happen, as someone who believes that, the government should do all it can to help make sure that the economy works for working people and that working people can get a fair wage or a livable wage, somebody who believes that you ought to be able to get retirement and that retirement ought to be secure when you get older, and someone who believes that you should have equal rights for all people, no matter who they might be, how do we talk about our values in a way that folks find compelling and fits within their worldview?
Well, first you have to understand where that comes from. That comes from what I've called the nurturant parent worldview. In that family model, you have two parents who are equally responsible. They have to protect and support their children and to make sure that their children can fulfill themselves in life. And not only that, their children want other people to be able to fulfill themselves in life, that they care about other people. Obama said it very well, that if you don't teach your children empathy, we'll have a generation of people who don't care about each other. And that is behind the central political views of progressives. And those can be stated, I think, best in about two sentences in general. One of them is from Abraham Lincoln, that in a democracy, you have a government of, by, and for the people. Of the people means that they're the same people, in government and out, that there's no line between them, that there's communication from people to the government and government to the people. By the people means that the people running your life through the government are going to have the same life experiences you have. Mm-hmm. And that's important. That's not true when billionaires are, running all the departments of government.
Yeah. Yeah.
For the people is a big deal. For the people says that the government has to care and act for the benefit of its citizens. And that's a very big deal. And that is something that conservatives absolutely do not believe. And then you have the second sentence is fairly simple, that from the beginning of our country, you had the idea that citizens care about other citizens, work through the government as an instrument to provide protection, well-being, and freedom for everybody equally. Mm-hmm. And this started at the very beginning, and it works also for business, since most people are in some business or other. And if you think about it, at the very beginning, what were the public resources? The public resources were not only roads and bridges, but public education, for example. Interstate commerce. For corporations, you had corporate law. Most of the justice system was set up for corporate law. You had a patent office, a national bank. All of this was set up as public resources for everybody. Equally. And the judicial system was to make sure that things like the First Amendment were kept there and then expanded upon. And this became very, very crucial as science developed. Because as science developed, something very important happened. As science developed, you got things like medical science. How did we get medical science? We paid for it. We paid for it through the NIH and public universities and so on. For nearly a century, we've been paying for the development of medical science, and we've already invested in it. And one of the arguments that ought to be made for single payer, which is a terrible name for universal health care for everybody, is that to a large extent, we've already paid for it. We've paid for the development. Training for all these people and for all those drugs and so on through our research. The other part that's very important in this history is the development of computer science.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't just fall out of the sky. It was paid for and developed through grants from DARPA and the National Science Foundation. There would be no computer science if that hadn't happened.
That's right.
And not only that, what about satellite communication? NASA and NOAA were, crucial in setting up and developing satellite communication.
Mm-hmm.
But what about cell phones? What about GPS systems? Those are maintained by our Defense Department in a way that most people don't realize because it's not publicized. We have, at any moment, at least 24 working satellites and more than 50 total in case any of them, the others fail, and going around the Earth at a 51-degree inclination from the equator so that At any point in Earth, there are four satellites that are, you know, sort of in connection with any point, sort of, that there's a line from any satellite down to any point on Earth. And how do you do a cell phone call? Well, you transmit from your phone to a tower, and the tower then switches that up to the satellite. Well, it goes to the satellite at the speed of light, because it's an electromagnetic signal. But at the satellite, it's then got to switch from one satellite to the next to the next. And then the question is, at each satellite, there is a switching system. It's got to switch. Then from satellite to satellite, in between, it goes at the speed of light. The next satellite, it's got to switch again. Then it's got to switch again. And if you're sending a cell phone call to Europe or, from California, where I am, what you're going to have to do is go around the world in these satellites, one to the next to the next. So how fast do the switching systems have to work? And the answer is they have to work at nanoseconds, billionths.
That's like less than a second for folks who may not know what a nanosecond is, right?
A billionth.
That's pretty fast, man.
Well, do you think that's fast? What if they're only a millionth of a second?
Yeah.
Then you're hundreds of miles off.
That's right.
If it goes as fast as only a millionth of a second, that's fast enough, but boy, not enough for a cell phone. And this is important. Our government maintains that system. The Russians and the Chinese are trying to put up a systems of their own right now. But right now, we are doing this. Now, how many businesses in the world depend on cell phones?
Nearly all of them now.
Nearly all of them. We are maintaining not only the economy of our country, but the economy of the world through our public resources.
Hmm.
That is, the private enterprise and private life absolutely depends on public resources. And this is something that's not said. And I've tried saying, when I say this to any Democratic office holder or any progressive, they will also all say, well, of course. And you tell them this story, and they say, wow, that's great, but of course that's true. And then you ask the next question, have you said it?
good point. Yeah.
And the answer is always no. And then there is, well, would you say it? And then they say, well, when would I say it? You know? And the answer is, you could say it every day as a justification for your legislation.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I mean, everything you said before, every point you made is about either government by, of, and for the people, or about this principle that the private depends on public resources. Every single bit of democratic legislation and progressive thought depends on those principles.
Well,
and
you're right.
They need to be out there. You know.
You know. You mentioned DARPA. That this is a program, I think it's the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency.
Yes.
This is an amazing agency. They've come up with the internet, as you just mentioned, universal translators, which allow you to talk to anybody, whether or not you speak their language, you know, GPS, you know, which we use, you know, all the time, Google Maps, all kinds of stuff, you know, that they've come up with, man. I mean, stealth aircraft, all kinds of things that we use every day, and, you know, stuff that's like the stuff of science fiction, but we don't know about it, and us folks who have this nurturing parent view of the world don't talk about how making investments in our society which benefit everyone is something that the government has done. In fact, we let them trash the government all the time, and we hardly stick up for it at all. I think you're right.
And the thing is, they see it as the government, as if the institution were some person out there.
Right.
And the government as sort of telling them what to do or something like that.
Yeah.
Right.
But the government is of and by us.
Right. That's it. It's not the government. It's the public. It's us.
Right. That's right. That's so right. Well, let me ask you this question. How come, you know, Republicans seem to get away with it. I mean, they say stuff like, I mean, I know that the people who vote for them have sort of this strict father mentality, but one thing you were telling me before is that not everybody is perfectly strict father or perfectly nurturing parent. People are some blend of the two. And so, you know, is it possible to try to appeal to people who are kind of a little bit strict father and try to show them that, hey, the government really has done some things that are really helping us?
Well, yes, but one should know a little bit about how this works. Remember that, first of all, what is a moderate? And it's important, a very important idea. A moderate conservative is someone who has some progressive ideas or other, varies from person to person. A moderate progressive is someone who has some conservative ideas, varies from person to person. But there is no ideology shared by all moderates.
Right.
There is no ideological center. And when people say, well, we should move to the center, that means you move to the right.
Yeah.
Right? It means you give up on what you believe.
Yeah.
And there is no center. And it's very important for our politics. People think if there's a left and a right, then you're on a line and there must be a center. That's a metaphor. That isn't true.
Right, right. Absolutely.
So it's important to know that. That's the first thing. Then there's a question to understand. How is it possible for you to have both worldviews, both in your brain? Remember, all ideas are in your brain. Every idea you have is in a neural circuit, and all complex ideas are in complex neural circuits. They're there in your brain. How is it possible for one brain to have two opposite worldviews going on at the same time? And the answer is actually very simple for any neuroscientist. It has to do with circuitry called mutual inhibition. The activation of one turns the other one off, whichever one it is. And the more one is turned on, the stronger it gets.
Oh, boy.
That's
yeah.
The thing. So why has the country become more conservative over the last 20 years? And the answer is that the Republicans did something very smart. They set up a thing called an institute, the Leadership Institute in Arlington, Virginia, and various think tanks to train people to think and talk conservative, to get those conservative ideas and forms of language out there. And the Leadership Institute announced in 2014, after 20 years of operation, that it had trained 159,000 people, conservatives, to go out there in their communities to think and talk conservative, and to be sent regular talking points, and to be booked on radio and TV and in various venues, businesses and business organizations and high schools and so on, to get their ideas out there every day, in addition to Fox News, which had only, 3 million people listening to them. But the point is, they had people out there all the time doing this for over 20 years, now 23 years, just doing it day after day after day. And what is that effect? If you have used conservative language is defined relative to conservative frames, conservative ideas, conservative moral worldview. The more you hear that language in your brain, every time you hear it, that worldview is activated and strengthened. It makes all sorts of people who, unless they're really resistant to it, more conservative.
Right.
Slowly but surely, bit by bit, day by day.
You know, George, one of the things that you're saying is, it's not just understanding the power of a word and the power of framing and how metaphors work and what frame of mind people are coming from. It's also important, what you're saying is that conservatives have kind of replicated this and really created a delivery system that allows them to deliver this conservative messaging all over the country through these Leadership Institute trainings you just mentioned. So it's not enough to say we've come up with a message. They've actually found a way to deliver that message. Is that what part of what you're saying as well?
That's what I'm saying, and they've done it in 15 countries.
15 countries, wow.
Hungary, Poland, France, all over the world, even Canada, you know, Mexico, they've got this stuff in 15 countries. And that, and you see this in right-wing movements throughout Europe and other countries.
Yeah, well, you know, you see it in Africa. I mean, you know, you saw, it was pretty surprising to me that in countries like Uganda and others, which were sort of like railing against gay rights, that there were some Americans who were mixed up in this whole thing and were pushing this. So, I guess you're right. This is an international movement that is trying to impose a certain worldview on everybody, not just Americans.
So think about what worldview Putin has.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Whether if you ever saw one.
Yeah, well, talk to me about that, because I've had folks tell me this, George. They say, oh, who cares about Russia? I mean, that's a distraction. I actually think Russia is super important because of Putin's worldview. I mean, they're not hacking 21 states' electoral systems just for nothing. They're not trying to, you know, seduce Trump and his team to engage them for nothing. They're not hacking the DNC for nothing. They're trying to replicate their way of thinking. Is that
That's
right?
Exactly right. And with Trump, they're getting a lot of success.
Yeah, well, talk about Trump for a minute. I mean, he seemed like somebody who kind of fits right into that strict father worldview to me.
Well, he does, and he's very, very smart at delivering his messages. People think he's dumb and so on, and he may not know a lot about, science or things like that, but he sure knows how to sell. He's a master salesman. And as a salesman, he knows certain things. One thing you do as a salesman is go to extremes. You say, this is the best car you'll ever see. This is the best car that's made, you know, if you're a car salesman, for example. You know, those other cars don't work. They're, you know, you might get in crashes. This will happen to you. This car is a disaster, you know, and so on. And that's what he's been doing. He's been using extremes where, like, this is great, terrific, beautiful, and the other is a disaster, ugly, and so on. And that is a common sales technique to do that. And there are other sales techniques that are used that he has. For example, there is a phenomenon discovered by Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize for behavioral economics. He discovered this idea that happens in everybody's brain back in the 1970s. At one point, there was a plane crash at O'Hare Airport in Chicago of a DC-10 that made an unfortunately bad turn during a huge windstorm, and it fell over and crashed. And that was shown on TV over and over and over. And after that, people decided they didn't want to fly on DC-10s, even though their overall record was the best in all airplanes. And the problem with this is that if you see something over and over and over, then it's that strong in your brain. You see it once, it activates that in your brain and gets stronger. The more you see it, the stronger it gets, until it changes your view of probability. You say, now this is going to happen to me. Now, what Trump does is he uses cases like someone who's a Muslim shoots some people or stabs some people somewhere in the country or in the world. Therefore, and that's shown over and over on TV, therefore all Muslims are terrorists. Right? You get that view, and that view occurs over and over constantly. In Chicago, there are a lot of murders in the African-American community.
Sure.
That means African-American communities are dangerous and full of murderers. And this is the sort of thing that is natural in our brains. Our brains do work that way. And Trump uses it, and he knows how to use it.
Yeah.
The other thing that he uses is tweets. And this is something that's extremely important. He is strategic in his tweets. The tweets are of four kinds. One is what I call preemptive framing. He wants to get the idea out there first. I'll give you an example in a minute. The second one is diversion. If there's something coming down at him, something about Russia or something else that's very embarrassing, he'll divert attention, attack Meryl Streep or, you know, or do something else to divert attention away from what's going on. The third is attacking the messenger, attacking the newspaper, the fake news, New York Times, etc. So you attack the messenger. And the fourth is trial balloons. If you have something outrageous or extreme to suggest, you try it out. And then you see what the reaction is. Now, all of his tweets are of one or more of those forms, and they're all diversions, basically. But let me give you an example. When he says that Trump Jr., who met with the Russians to get information against Hillary, Trump Jr. is really a good boy. Well, why does he use the word boy? Trump Jr. is 39 years old, the same as President Macron of France. He's, you know, and not only that, Trump put him in charge of the entire world business empire of Trump. You know, he's hardly a boy. But what does the word boy say? The boy has a frame. A boy is someone who is naive, who may mean well and make mistakes, but not to be blamed for it, you know, just to be chided, maybe, you know, spanked a little bit or told not to do it again, and so on. That is, it's something that says, don't take this seriously. And that's the frame that he's putting on this. Another frame he puts on it is that, well, any politician would get oppo research in which he's saying, oh, he's not a boy anymore, he's now a politician. But now it's normal. This is just the normal thing that people do in politics when treason is not normal.
That's right. I think you're right about that. So I've heard some liberal progressives say Trump's dumb. And it sounds like you don't buy that.
I don't buy that. Trump may not be informed about many things. I think he may even have a reading problem. There's some colleagues of mine who specialize in reading and say he often shows what looks like a reading deficit. And that may be true since he likes to watch TV and not get reports. Mm-hmm. So that's conceivable, but he certainly doesn't, you know, he doesn't know the details of healthcare plans. He says, who could imagine that healthcare
right.
could have been complicated? Anybody who's followed it would imagine it.
Yeah.
But the point is that, you know, that doesn't mean he's unintelligent. He's very intelligent when it comes to selling things. And what is he selling? He's selling himself. He's selling his ideas. And he's selling his view of the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you, going forward, what do you think, you know, people who have a nurturing parent view of the world should be doing? What do you think we need to focus our attention on? I would imagine you might say we need to start training people to speak within the frame of the nurturing parent model. That might be one thing.
Exactly. That's just what you need to do. You have to say everything from a moral perspective. Politics is about morality. Anyone who puts forth a proposal assumes that it's right, not wrong. Nobody says, here's my policy, but it's evil. You know, but go do it. You know, or it doesn't matter, but go do it. The
right.
assumption is right, and you got to say what right is, and you got to give those basic principles. You know, government by for and of the people, government. That produces public resources for everybody. That the private depends on the public. I mean, these are things that need to be said over and over, and then you give your details. And then you say them, and you have to also have the courage to say certain things that are not normally out there yet. You know, talk about the importance of net neutrality. You know, why does net neutrality matter? It matters a lot in everybody's life, but they don't know it yet. Why does it matter, what the Wall Street rules on loans are? Matters a lot. You know, all sorts of things like that matter, and they have to be talked about in a reasonable way, and they have to be told why they're right. And you have to have the courage to go beyond the normal views. Why does it matter to have universal health care? What is badly called single payer, but or Medicare for all, whatever. The point is that it does matter, and that we have already paid for most of it. Mm-hmm. We should be getting our dividends for having paid for it. Yes, it matters. Does student debt matter? There are 44 million people in this country with huge amounts of student debt that is keeping them from living their lives like reasonable people, and also keeping them from actually being a major part of our economy. What's wrong with that picture? What's wrong with it is a very basic principle. You do not want to mislabel a public good as a private good. Education is a public good. It's good for everybody. Education is good for my education, your education, my children's and grandchildren's education is good for the country, because we need citizens, we need educated people in our economy, we need it everywhere in our civilian life, in neighborhoods. We need educated people. It's not just that it's good for the person who gets the education, it's good for all of us. You know, there should be the ability to have free college for everybody, free higher education in some form or other, or highly subsidized ones. And the idea, and at least, if you're going to get a loan, get it at mortgage rates, you know, not at the huge interest rates that now are forced on people who get college loans, and therefore drive it up. You know, it would be better if we just, you know, if the government realized that this was a public good and paid off the loans, got it, you know, and gave, and many of them are loans to the government, from the government itself, from us. We're, you know, it's namely the debt is to the rest of the country, and just say, look, this is a public good. It's going to be good for everybody in the future. It's going to help the economy. It's going to help those 44 million people be productive citizens out there. That's important.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, you know, George, I want to say thanks for spending time talking to me, and thanks for all the writing you've done, and I want to encourage you to continue. We really need your help in this hour. Let's stay in touch, okay?
Let's definitely stay in touch, and thank you, Keith.
You bet, buddy. Have a good one now.
We have to do a better job of talking to people, especially working people. We have to do a better job of telling the story. We have to use brain science and understand exactly how the human mind works so that we can be better at communication, so that we can confront lies that some politicians and political leaders use, and so that we can help people get on their own side. Not with facts and figures, but with making a strong moral appeal to people on their most deeply held beliefs. For We the Podcast, this is Keith Ellison, and we'll see you next time. Hey, do me a favor, head on over to the We the Podcast iTunes page and rate, review, and subscribe. The more you do that, the more folks will listen to We the Podcast, and we definitely believe that that's a good idea. This episode of We the Podcast was produced by Brett Morrow and Isaiah Kirshner-Breen.